You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, you might not know it when you look at the surface of Lake Mendota or Lake Monona, but there are a lot of pretty random things strewn around the bottom of those lakes. Think cars or gas grills. We'll talk to a maritime archaeologist who's been examining what's at the bottom of that lake system.
First, the Kewaskum School District in southeastern Wisconsin says it's trying to solve a big problem: students using smartphones during class. In fact, Kewaskum's vice principal told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that phone use is the number one discipline issue.
The district went as far as asking the village for an ordinance that would allow students to be ticketed for repeatedly violating its cell phone policy. The village board took up the issue yesterday, and to quote President Kevin Scheinemann, it crashed and burned badly by a vote of 7-0. On top of that, nobody, including school district officials, were present to speak in favor of the measure. Scheinemann told WISN-TV in Milwaukee that he actually supported the idea, but without anyone to explain why it was necessary, he voted no.
You know, if the school district wants to do something like this in the future, they at least have to be here to defend the proposal. That, you know, I think that's what really hurt them tonight.
Joining us now to talk more about this proposal is the superintendent of Kewaskum School District, James Smozzel. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
So tell us originally where this idea for this policy came from.
So I think we need to start as a whole state issue that has been something that's been bantered about at many conferences and workshops throughout the state over the last year or two. And based on some of the articles that I've been reading, all school districts, depending on where they are with technology, is something that we struggle with and what we're trying to accomplish in the classroom. And trying to keep children first and learning first, obviously, is our highest priority. And we were fortunate enough to finally be able to be one-to-one with Chromebooks across our entire district. And this is the first time this has happened at the high school. So up until this point in time, we had a bring-your-own-device type mentality and policy in the high school. And now that we're one-to-one in Chromebooks, we thought it was appropriate to now take a look at cell phone usage at our high school. And so as we looked across the state and we looked at different policies and we looked at the one that most people are trying to kind of copy and paste, emulate, is Germantown's policy. And we shared that with our local police force and gave the school board a heads up if this is something they wanted us to pursue. And unanimously, our school board said, yes, if this is a concern and it's taking away from student learning, of course we want you to take a look at it. So we did, and we did a year's worth of research. And on July 9th at our board retreat, which we do every summer with our leadership team, we rolled out what we wanted to do. And in these third and fourth offenses, if appropriate and if our local law enforcement wanted to allow a citation or have a citation for cell phones, we wanted to make that available and work with them and partner with them on that. Obviously, once again, going back to the Germantown policy, which if you're emulating it, that's what they did and the partnership they have with their law enforcement. And so that was suggested that we do that, and so it was brought back to our local police force, and they took it to the village. And, of course, we don't issue tickets. That's not our realm of responsibility. So it's just a tool in the toolbox for us as far as trying to deal with student management issues from a day-to-day, year-to-year basis. And they did not think it was appropriate to have a separate ticket for cell phone usage, which is their business, and they have the right to do that. And, you know, it doesn't change the fact that we have a board policy dealing with cell phones, and we're going to do our best to try to make it the best learning environment we can. And whether or not there was a ticketing offense, that was up to them. And if they choose not to do it, that's fine. We will continue to move on and do what we do.
So this policy proposal went to the village board last night, and from what we heard there from WISN-TV, no one from the school district was there to speak in support of it. Why do you think that was?
Well, there's a couple of things that go into it. First of all, our representative, assistant principal Bingham, went to the board meeting prior to this, and he shared what the district was thinking about doing and wanted to partner with the village Village and the local police department on this. So there was somebody there at the previous board meeting, and they said they wanted to bring it back. In between the two meetings, I contacted the chief of police and met with him personally and said, what are the concerns? Do you need us to be there? What would you like us to do to help you with this? And you trying to get this approved by your board. And he said that there wasn't anything that we needed to do and that we weren't needed to show up. It's their board meeting. It's their police department. I felt the responsibility to allow him to kind of guide us on whether or not he wanted us there. And it was decided that we weren't needed, and therefore we didn't attend.
What have you heard from teachers in your district? Is this something that they have been asking for? Because do they feel like their power in the classroom can only go so far to control this kind of behavior on cell phone usage?
You know, before being a superintendent, I spent 17 years in a high school with student management and other things, 11 years as a high school principal. And I can tell you, it wasn't very often, but from time to time, I was called down to a classroom where there was some type of student management issue that I had to get involved with, and the teacher called me down to remove the student from the classroom and take them to the office because they wouldn't go on their own. And at some point, a lot of times I had to basically say to the student in question, you know, I have certain limitations for me. I can't grab you by the hand and take you down to the office. I can't put handcuffs on you. I can't issue you a citation. But if you don't want to come with me now, and I can threaten you with suspensions and I can threaten you with detentions, and that doesn't mean a lot to some kids, especially when they're angry. And so that tool in the toolbox to say, you know, our local law enforcement can come down here and they can do those things. That's the way our society works. And more times than not, that's the impetus for them to come down to the office because they didn't want a ticket. So there comes some very few and far between, very severe quick cases that quote-unquote tool in the toolbox is needed to run a safe and orderly school district or any type of organizations. That's why we have an SRO program. We have a school resource officer in the building every day, and we partner with our local law enforcement on a myriad of issues that deal with student management. And so it's a great working partnership. I don't think either us or our local police force thinks that we abuse it. It's a good working relationship, and this would just be, you know, something similar to that. And we wanted to see if that's what they wanted to do because, once again, it's not something that we created ourselves. We were trying to use the same type of thought process that other school districts across the state were using. And they chose not to do it, and they have the right to do that. It would be advantageous, I guess, if people would more clearly understand the role of a school district and the role of a local municipality and law enforcement, because I think the lines got blurred there a little bit. But, you know, we support our local police. We support our village board. We do our thing, and we will continue to try to make it a safe and appropriate, great place for kids to learn.
We are talking right now with Jim Smazel of the Kewaskum School District. He's the superintendent there, and we are talking about cell phones and cell phones in the classroom. And, Jim, you had mentioned that you're at a point where every student has a Chromebook. Students are still going to have their cell phones. Various schools across the state have dealt with this in different ways. Milwaukee Public Schools have said no cell phones in the classroom. Others have been more open to it. Do you see a role for cell phones in learning and in curriculum in your schools?
Well, I believe what we tried to do is to give every student, whether they're a high-need students or low-income students, every student the opportunity to learn. And that was the impetus for going one-to-one with our Chromebooks. So in essence, the cell phone need for a portal for learning is not necessary anymore. And so when it's not necessary, just like you and I, if it's something's not necessary, it can easily become a distraction or a safety concern. And so we would like to limit that. And again, we are just asking that students, when they come to school, we know they're going to have a cell phone, that they just leave it in their locker. and we have a five-period day. We're on a trimester schedule, so there's 8 minutes in between classes that they can go to their locker. They can check their cell phones in between classes before they go to lunch, after they come back from lunch. And after school, they can pick it up and they can use it as soon as the bell rings. So we're just looking at it specifically during the class period times and in the classrooms. We know that kids are going to have cell phones. We know that that's the way the world and our society works. That's not what we're trying to take away. We're just trying to, again, when they're in the classroom, let's concentrate on learning. If you need a portal for technology, we will provide it and take those distractions away.
Very briefly, Jim, as we begin to wrap up, what kind of conversations are you going to be having on this topic going forward?
Well, I think we need to try to get a greater awareness of what the role of a school district is versus the role of the local municipality and the law enforcement, and where our areas of coverage are versus theirs, and that we never were asking for them to ultimately give a ticket. It was also, it was just an opportunity, like I have said before, as a tool in the toolbox, something that we would use in very extreme cases, that they could issue a ticket if the law enforcement chose to do so. And, you know, we'll still continue on without that. We've got great kids. We didn't expect that to be something that we would have to entertain very often. But it's okay because, you know, we're all learning. We're all growing. We're all at different spots. I mean, if I'm a school district that doesn't have one-to-one, I understand why you want to have cell phones in the classroom. So,
and we're going to have to leave it there. Jim, thank you so much for joining us. That was James Smozzle, superintendent of the Keewascom School District. We talked to him about the Village Board rejecting a district proposal that would fine students who repeatedly get caught using cell phones in class.
First, you've probably heard of shipwrecks in the Great Lakes, but imagine for a moment boat wrecks, barbecues, and maybe even some cars littering the bottom of the Yahara Lakes, like Lake Mendota.
There's a lot of stuff on the bottom of these smaller lakes, and there's a lot that we can learn from what's down there.
Tamara Thompson is a maritime archaeologist with the Wisconsin Historical Society. Tamara, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about maritime archaeology. What does that mean?
Well, mostly I work on shipwrecks of the state. So we have more than 750 shipwrecks that were lost in state water, state bottomlands. And we go out and do about 3 to 5 surveys a summer where we do what's called phase 2 archaeology. We survey everything we see in place. And then we try to understand how the ship was constructed and why it went down. Hmm. And really get a catalog of some of the cultural materials that were taken down to the bottom. I mean, you can imagine they're like time capsules. What was aboard and what shipboard life was like, what people brought with them to work, because they worked on these vessels and sometimes lived there, really shows a period in time, a point in time when the ship sank. So it's really a fascinating career. I've been very blessed to have it. And yeah, it's very interesting. Fun to share.
I know that there are some conditions that are better for preserving archaeological artifacts and things like that. It seems like deserts are good because, you know, things are under sand and they're protected. What about water? What does water do to a wreck?
Well, in the Great Lakes, we don't have things they have in the ocean, like teredo worms and salt. Water breaks down things faster as well. So we have fresh water. It's low oxygen levels and dark. And so the sites are very, very well preserved. We do have invasive quagga mussels. So the zebra mussels, as we all know, have learned about, have really been outcompeted by the quaggas. And so now those completely cover the shipwrecks and completely cover the bottom. So we're ending up with a couple problems with those invasives, but we're, you know, really on a fast pace to try to catalog the metal wrecks before they degrade over time.
So there are obviously the big lakes, Lake Superior, Lake Michigan, but there are also thousands of other lakes in Wisconsin. And you've done a lot of work in the Yahara Lakes.
Yes.
What do you find at the bottom of them and place them for us in Wisconsin?
Sure. So the Yahara chain of lakes is Madison-based, really. So we have 4 lakes. We have Mendota, Monona, Wabisa, and Kiganza. And they are, the objects that we see in them are very different than what we see on the Great Lakes. We're looking at, on the Great Lakes, mostly commercial vessels. Mm-hmm. And that's really where the focus of my work had been. And then very opportunistically here in these lakes, we had a gentleman named Rick Krieger, and he was a radio technician for the city of Madison. He did 911 compliance to make sure that the fire and police departments could talk to each other on the radios and did installation in that. And when he retired, he decided to take up side scan sonaring, and he divided the lakes into small sections and then systematically started looking at what was on the bottom.
Wow.
So he gave me the opportunity to work with him and to go looking at what we call targets of opportunity. So these are things that look like cultural items. Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. Sometimes they're a log. Sometimes it's, you know, a chair that drifted away or a piece of pier or something like that. And to really look at the different items that are on the bottom. So what we see here in the Yahara Lakes are small fishing craft and things that would be lost off of someone's pier, but also dating back in time, we had a number of excursion vessels which were on our lakes, and so we see the remains of some of those as well. So, you know, the early days of sort of Madison tourism and going out on the lakes and going to places like Picnic Point by excursion vessel, or going over to, you know, Governor's Island, those would be done on these sort of smaller steamboats, and the remains of them are on the bottom, too.
We're talking with Tamara Thompson. She's a maritime archaeologist with the Wisconsin Historical Society and the Maritime Preservation and Archaeology Program there. And we're talking about what's on the bottom of the Yahara Lakes system. And Tamara, I can only imagine that there is a huge range of things that you have found down there. Do you have some favorite finds?
Well, my favorite one is really a mistake. So sometimes we like to think that GPS coordinates are very, very accurate, and they can be, but also because of atmospheric disturbances and that, you can be off by a few feet or so, maybe a few hundred feet in some cases. Rick put me on one of these targets, and we went out in the morning. It was in about 55 feet of water, and he said, I don't know what this is. It's a blob on the bottom, but he found it again on his sonar through a marker, and then I rolled overboard and went down to the bottom. 55 feet is relatively deep for the Madison Lakes, and went to the bottom, and I found a gas grill. And so then he came back and says, there's another target that's not very far from here. So we went out and searched for it and came back around. He's like, it seems like it's not in the right place. But he says, here it is on the bottom, threw the marker in again. And you know what it was? It was the gas grill. So I got to dive on that gas grill twice. If it wasn't exciting enough the first time. So that's my favorite story of the
Madison. And you wonder how that gas grill got out there.
And in the middle of the lake.
Yeah.
I don't know. So I would like to think it fell off a pontoon boat and there was a real ruckus party going on. That would be fun.
I guess we'll never know, probably, unless someone hears this and says, yeah, hey, that's my gas grill. So I'm sure you, as you said, you find a lot of boats, watercrafts, but I'm guessing having seen cars out on the lakes,
yep,
for ice fishing, that maybe you found one or two of those.
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't know what year it was prohibited for the driving on the ice. However, for many, many years, people did go out and access the ice for pleasure or also for ice fishing by car. And there's a notorious crack. I like to go ice boating, and so we know about this crack that runs between Fox Bluff and Picnic Point. And so there's always this huge ice ridge there now. And there was also, around the 1900s. And there are a few cars that are lost off of Fox Bluff, right where that crack is. And they're all in the same place. There's three of them that are on the bottom. And unfortunately, some of them are associated with some tragic deaths. But they are in pristine condition. Some of them are sitting upright on the on the bottom with the keys still in them.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's really kind of amazing to come across these items on the bottom.
It has to be sometimes a little eerie, feeling like you really are seeing a snapshot of a moment when something went under.
Oh, absolutely. So, and to really connect with that and then try to go back and search through the newspaper archives and figure out if there was some sort of report or trace of this small boat on the bottom or this or this car, or, you know, why there would be part of a wagon somewhere, and try to piece that together. And we're still in the process of figuring it out. There's a number of mysteries that are still out there. And so there's always new things that Rick's finding. He hasn't completed his survey. So you never know what next year's going to bring.
What is the value of this type of archaeology? What can we learn? How does it inform, you know, other work?
The value of it really is that it tells our history. It's a snapshot of what was going on in a point in time. It tells about us as citizens of Madison how we might have taken garbage out on the ice to get it out of the cities and to keep the cities clean, and then it fell through the ice and there are these rubbish piles on the bottom. They're interesting. You can go through them and find a lot of really interesting finds if you like digging through garbage. But you know, that tells a little bit of our history. Or when you see these excursion vessels, we don't think about excursion vessels on the lake. We see Betty Lou out there on occasion, the Grand Mariner. And we don't really think of this time where there was boat building here in Madison, and that they built these excursion vessels, and that was a business, and that was part of this sort of pleasure movement that was going on in our city, and it got people away from the cities. You know, the cities were a dirty and maybe environmentally poor place to be, and so to go out into the countryside and have a picnic on Maple Bluff was certainly something, and it kind of connects you back to that little bit of history. So as far as value, like dollars and cents, I don't know how you could put a value on that. And I certainly don't think many of these items could be recovered after being on the bottom, but it certainly is a treasure.
Well, Tamara, thanks so much for sharing your passion with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That was Tamara Thompson. She's a maritime archaeologist with the Wisconsin Historical Society's Maritime Preservation and Archaeology Program. She joined us to talk about the interesting finds that are on the bottom of the Yahara Lakes. Now, a sensitive topic and a potentially upsetting and triggering conversation. A Pennsylvania grand jury released an extensive report last week detailing decades of sexual abuse of children by Catholic clergy.
The report found more than 1,000 children suffered abuse by some 300 priests at 6 dioceses in Pennsylvania. The release of the report shocked people across the country and has many Catholics grappling with their faith in light of the news. Our next guest is here to talk about how the church is handling the recent report and how Catholics are processing this new information.
Eileen Burke Sullivan is an associate professor in the Department of Theology and vice provost of mission and ministry at Creighton University. Eileen, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much.
Tell me first, what was your reaction when this news came out of Pennsylvania?
Well, I was in Boston when the crisis there broke in 2001 and 2002, and that, I thought, sort of did me in some ways. But I have to say that this was a renewal of that experience. I was shocked at how similar it all sounded and how much of the same kinds of content in some ways were a part of the whole experience.
And what reactions have you seen to this new report among Catholics that you know? Let's start first at people who basically work in Catholic institutions and are working in their faith every day.
Well, and that would be a place like Creighton, which is a Catholic Jesuit university, and a number of our employees have mentioned their concern, and particularly younger adults are expressing dismay. And, you know, it's when somebody, I've been around a little bit longer than some of them, and so I as I said, I experienced something very similar with the Boston crisis back in between 2000 and 2002, but that's now almost two decades ago, and so that there's a whole generation of adult Catholics who have matured, and you think that there's nothing that could shock, but I just think that's not the case. I think the sheer quantity of this report and the fact that it hasn't been revealed until now are dismaying to people, to say the least. And I've heard, you know, people that I think are pretty committed Catholics say that they're grateful that they are a little better educated in the faith and understand that the priests are not the church, They're members, but they're not the whole thing. And so they don't feel that it's going to drive them out of the faith. But it certainly makes us sad and miserable, especially for the families that have suffered this kind of thing.
Well, and as you said, this is nearly two decades after the situation in Boston, and there have been allegations of abuse like this for years in the church. There have been other investigations, both within the church and without. There have been other disturbing conclusions. What is it about this report at this time that, like you said, seems to really be rocking people?
Well, I think there's several pieces. I think the size of it, the fact that it's six dioceses together in a fairly heavily Catholic populated area indicates that there's been a significant amount. I think, too, part of the problem, too, is that the report spans seven decades, which would span much of the same time as the Boston report, but then including the last two decades. And so I think people are frightened and angry that there have been any new reports since, say, 2000. That's outrageous, especially since the bishops committed themselves to doing something about it. And then I think the other big piece that I hear from Catholics is the anger that, again, and this was similar then too, but that those in authority, bishops especially, have known about this or have had some awareness and haven't taken good steps to protect children.
Well, and as you said, in the wake especially of the Boston scandal, there was a commitment from the hierarchy of the church saying, this ends now, we're going to do whatever it takes. And yet, as we have found out, that was not the case, at least in the area, the diocese that are covered in this report. What had the bishops and the cardinals said that they would do, if anything, that was concrete, and what did or didn't happen?
Well, they had indicated very strongly that they would report to proper authorities any credible accusations, and that they would remove immediately from active ministry any priest or diocesan employee, lay or priest, lay or ordained. They would remove them immediately from any kind of public ministry, and certainly anything to do with children, but any kind of public ministry. And then they would report on each year on the numbers and outcomes and so on, at least to their own committees and one thing or another. I think probably what hasn't happened is that those reports, I'm not sure there's been a compilation. I'm not also sure that every bishop has done it, I think the biggest thing, and they said it back at that time, was that the committees who were appointed were very often appointed by the bishops and accountable to the bishops, and if the bishops were the problem, it's very hard to report to them.
Eileen Burke Sullivan is an associate professor in the Department of Theology and also vice provost of mission and ministry at Creighton University. We are talking about the latest episode in the sexual abuse scandals that have rocked the Catholic Church. And Eileen, certainly, there's no doubt that there are very good and honorable priests and bishops and cardinals in the Catholic Church. But this report found that about 300 priests in six dioceses abused approximately 1,000 children. That is a horrific concentration of abuse. What do you think explains that kind of widespread abuse and criminality?
Well, for one thing, you're looking at a relatively small number of priests, ironically, something like 3 or 4%, but they're serial abusers. They abuse many children, and the breakdown is that they are not identified and prevented from ministry, and that there is a kind of intuition about what children will not reveal, them and so forth. Now, I can't imagine that parents today would not believe their children, but again, we're talking about a report that goes back seven decades. So if you look at, say, the first four of those decades, let's say, that the culture wouldn't have been as willing to, especially in a largely Catholic area of the country, wouldn't have been as willing to hear negative things about priests. I think in the most recent years, that would have been much more, the children would have been much more readily believed or accepted. I would find it hard to believe that parents wouldn't grapple with that, but then, you know, or schools. I mean, the mandatory reporting legally across the country has really sharpened since the Boston thing. So, you know, I'd have to break the report down, which I have not had an opportunity to do, but to really break it down much more carefully about what specifically has happened in the last 20 years and what numbers we're talking about in 20 years. Because it wouldn't be overwhelmingly different from, say, Boston, numerically or otherwise, to say 800 children those years and still leave 200, although 200 children in the last 20 years would be a disaster. So, I mean, I think it's a disaster, period. The numbers are horrific. You are correct about that. But it's clear that there's a serial behavior and, you know, the believability and the culture that surrounds it and so on. So I think that culture has changed largely in the secular, you know, in among families and so on, but maybe not in that part of the country. I'm not sure.
Of course, it's entirely natural to want to assign responsibility and blame for the situation, find out
sure.
who should have stopped this. And there are different theories as to where the blame lies. Bishop Robert Morlino of the Madison Diocese here in Wisconsin released a letter in light of the report where he blamed gay priests and homosexuality for the years of abuse. Is that a commonly held belief in the Catholic Church?
Well, because the number of circumstances are male-on-male sexual abuse, at least that are reported numerically, that would at least incline one to say that there are that perpetrators are operating out of a homosexual inclination of some kind. I've just read his letter, and I have to say that he kind of is clear. He does mention the homosexual issue, but he doesn't mention it as if it were alone. He speaks of any sexual expression outside of marital relationship, which would be male-female as well, or the entering of clerics into intimate sexual relationships at all, so to men or to women. And then he mentions, and I think wisely, that coercion or power, the use of power, is a part of this whole mélange of evil that's part of it. I think that it's problematic to go to either heterosexuality or homosexuality or gayness or straightness by itself. There's a whole set of issues of integration of one's sexuality in a healthy way, understanding. But what is problematic are groups of unhealthy sexual predators supporting each other, whether they're gang raping women or children or boys or girls or whatever the case might be. That kind of unhealthy predation by any group is genuinely sick, and it is evil. He names it correctly there. A too rapid movement to identify this strictly as homosexual is clearly problematic. On the other hand, to ignore that there is a substantial homosexual behavior, sexual operation here, and one would have to ask the question, are they not being reported, or are they not being attacked? I mean, is this, and certainly the seminarian on seminarian or priest on seminarian behavior is male on male, and I'm wondering how much of that is unhealthy sexual self-awareness and integration of any kind. And possibly there for a substantive. And you think of the years of the homosexuals being diminished and dismissed by the church for simply being, not just not behaving homosexually, but just by being homosexual. So that's changed. Fortunately, the church does not teach that being homosexual is evil, but it does continue to hold that homosexual sex is evil. But I'm wondering if there's been an adequate reflection about sexuality, period, in a lot of our seminaries, and if there is an attraction in some the subcultures of the church to young men who are vulnerable toward the power of priesthood, and then have not adequately dealt with their own issues, that then they turn around and become predators.
And we're talking right now with Eileen Burke Sullivan. She's an associate professor in the Department of Theology and vice provost of mission and ministry at Creighton University. She's with us to talk about the future of the Catholic Church following a grand jury report detailing abuse by priests.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. If you are Catholic, how are you responding to the grand jury report? What do you think the future of the Catholic Church will be and your role in it? If you're a Catholic or if you're a former Catholic, what would need to change to restore your faith in the church? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We continue our conversation now about an extensive report released by a Pennsylvania grand jury last week that detailed 70 years of sexual abuse of children and teenagers by Catholic priests. Our guest is Eileen Burke Sullivan. She's an associate professor in the Department of Theology and vice provost of mission and ministry at Creighton University.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. If you're a Catholic, what was your reaction to this report? What changes do you think should come to the Catholic Church? Has this news challenged your faith in the church? And what questions do you have? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us, ideas@wpr.org.
And Eileen, Pope Francis addressed the issue over the weekend. Tell us what he said and what message he sent out to the Catholic faithful.
Well, I think he has iterated on a number of occasions very strongly that this is intolerable and that in no part of the world should children be victimized by anyone, and that it's up to everyone to be responsible for that. I think he also spoke very strongly that it would not be tolerated by authority and that they would do everything possible to make sure people are held accountable.
Were there specifics in how he's planning to deal with this?
I don't believe this particular letter was as specific as he'd like to make it, and I think he will make it specific as he goes along. But I think he has to deal with each national culture differently. And, I mean, obviously his role in the Chilean situation, where he called for the resignation of all the bishops, and they did submit all of them, submitted their resignations. He hasn't yet accepted all of them, but he has at least has their resignations in hand, is a major move. And if he would do that in the United States, it would be hugely dramatic. It would, because there are so many. I really don't know what specific steps, but he's quite capable of specific steps. So I would expect those in the next few months.
What can the Catholic Church do to reassure Catholic faithful that change and really concrete change is going to happen so that in another 20 years there is not another bombshell like this?
Well, I think various groups have put forward ideas. I'm not sure there's any very singular idea. Bishop Marlino certainly put together some strong suggestions and decisions for his own diocese and recommendations for others. There's several groups of clergy have spoken very strongly about things that they would expect. I would anticipate there will be other groups that will weigh in and say we should be doing this or that. I think without any question, the bishops themselves have got to come clean with recognizing that they cannot defend their own from if they have information and so forth, that they have to hold each other accountable. I would hope that they will develop independent reporting bodies within the faith community that are not going to depend on the bishop's favor or his approval. That's not been the custom in the past, and so it would be a major change. What do the laity need? I think they need to see, a real sense of transformation. I mean, really accurate reporting and a kind of generalized sense that things are better, and that particularly children are being protected. But now I think they're very concerned about even college level kids or young seminarians and so on. I mean, that's a very significant charge that has to be addressed.
Eileen, I want to go to our callers now, and Mike in Lake Mills is up. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to add a few things to the discussion. Number one, my principal, Father Kelly, approached me twice, once when I was a freshman and once in my senior year of high school. And I remember my senior year, I told my mother it was the only time ever that she hit me. Washed my mouth out with soap and told me never talk about a priest like that again. Now, this was 1974, so yeah, people didn't talk about it then. The next thing I'd like to ask is, number one, there is nothing, no research, no facts anywhere that state that men that rape and molest and torture little boys are homosexuals. The bishop likes to throw that word homosexual in there to divert the blame, not from the church, not from the priest, but on those dirty, filthy little homos.
All right, and we need to leave a little time here for Eileen to respond. Eileen, briefly?
Well, a closer reading of the bishop's letter doesn't exactly, I don't know Bishop Molino that well, but I would have to say that the letter doesn't support, that strong a statement. I think the issue that you raise about 1974 was very much a parental culture. I cannot imagine parents in 2018 behaving the same way. But, I suppose there would be some few. But that's why I'm surprised that there aren't sort of more watchdogs in the community, so to speak.
Well, Eileen, thank you so much for joining us today. Obviously, a lot more in this topic. Eileen Burke Sullivan is an associate professor in the Department of Theology and vice provost of Mission and Ministry at Creighton University.